You're listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. Well, these days, there is a lot of talk about the demagogic style of President Donald Trump. Historian Reinhard Luthen defined a demagogue as a politically skilled person in oratory, flattery, and invective, appealing to the passions rather than the reason of the public and arousing racial, religious, and class prejudices. Republican Senator Joe McCarthy embodied most of those traits. McCarthy was the catalyst behind the Army-McCarthy hearings. Known for alleging numerous communists and Soviet spies and sympathizers infiltrated the U.S. federal government, universities, the film industry, and elsewhere, people across the country were riveted to the wall-to-wall television and radio coverage of those hearings in 1954. Here is Senator McCarthy at one of those hearings in the spring of that year.
Once you have this United States, from the Atlantic to the Pacific, covered with a network of professors and teachers who are getting their orders from Moscow, from an organization that wants to destroy this nation, that wants to corrupt the minds of youth, then we are rapidly losing the battle.
Larry Tai is the author of a new book called Demagogue, The Life and Long Shadow of Senator Joe McCarthy. Tai says while Trump and Joe McCarthy had very different backgrounds, they both have become known as demagogues and sometimes bullies.
Yes, so I actually only mentioned Donald Trump in the preface, in the epilogue, and that's intentional because this is a book about Joe McCarthy, but I think that there is no question that Donald Trump borrowed his playbook. On a day-to-day basis, you see it in terms of everything that Joe McCarthy stood for and everything Joe McCarthy did. And that would be sort of pure speculation and just looking at what Trump said and what McCarthy said if there wasn't a human through line. And that human through line is Roy Cohn, the young, aggressive, brilliant, probably amoral attorney who was Donald Trump's tutor, and half a century before was Joe McCarthy's protege. And he took all the things that he had learned from Joe McCarthy and quite consciously passed them on to Donald Trump.
Looking at the two, I'm thinking to myself, you know, and I'd heard of Joe McCarthy's childhood before in Wisconsin. You know, he was raised in a relatively modest home with Irish Catholic parents, not a lot of money. But Joe McCarthy was very determined to rise above all this and really make good, wasn't he?
He was, and from a very early point, he made clear that part of doing that was getting the affirmation of his fellow Wisconsinites by running for office and winning. And he tried doing that at a young age, running in a very brash campaign for district attorney. He was at that time a liberal FDR New Deal type, and he ran as a Democrat. He realized that in his part of Wisconsin, he couldn't get elected as a Democrat. So he not only turned himself into a Republican, he turned himself into the iconic figure for the most conservative forces in the Republican Party. So from New Deal liberal to very conservative Republican without a blink of an eye or any embarrassment at that kind of flip-flop.
I was just interested to see how McCarthy went from being someone who finished high school basically in, I don't know, a matter of 18 months or something like that after raising chickens and doing eggs and all that, sort of his own business as a teenager. And then he moves on to Marquette, goes to college, goes to law school, has all these jobs. I mean, he's someone who always seemed to have another idea to sort of finance his future. I mean, he seemed to never be at a loss.
Yes. So he was, if you were a McCarthy fan, you would say he was incredibly enterprising, the perfect young entrepreneur who turned himself into a chicken tycoon, who turned himself into an elected official at a very young age, and who showed that he had incredible chutzpah and incredible ability at making things work. If you were a McCarthy cynic, you would say he did whatever it took to get ahead, and that could be changing political parties, changing ideologies, or basically embellishing and lying his way into office, which is also something that he did quite effectively.
Yeah, well, he also was in World War II, and he's sort of known as Tail Gunner Joe, and people, especially journalists, have wondered whether or not, and said this wasn't necessarily true, that Joe McCarthy never went up in a plane, never was in battle in World War II, but you say that he was.
His World War II military diaries, his real-time diaries that when he was in the South Pacific, he was keeping, they showed that rather than tail gunner, the notion of him being a tail gunner being an exaggeration, that while he was, his official duty was as a land-based intelligence officer, he volunteered to go up and fly in perilous missions as a tail gunner, and that all the things that he had said, that journalists said, were embellishments, if not outright lies, were in fact true. And that is what happens, I think, when over time you develop a reputation as an embellisher or a liar. When you're actually telling the truth, nobody believes you.
When he got back, you write about when he gets out of the service and he starts running for offices, he becomes a district judge, you know, and then he seems to have a pretty quick progression in these smaller offices to running for the Senate. And when he runs for the Senate, he takes on a big family in Wisconsin. And I don't know if a lot of people today talk about, the La Follette family. I think you used to call him Fighting Bob La Follette, and they were, you say that they were the Kennedys of Wisconsin kind of thing.
They were. So in Massachusetts, we know this dynastic family that I wrote my last book about, the Kennedys, that they had extraordinary power, and running here as a Kennedy carries extraordinary weight. In Wisconsin, at least as powerful were the La Follettes. There was the senior La Follette, they called him Fighting Bob. There was his son that they called Young Bob. And between the two of them, they had held the seat for more than a generation. Between the two of them, they looked unbeatable. And between the two of them, it looked like a quixotic, if not an idiotic thing, for Joe McCarthy to take on Young Bob in this Republican primary. McCarthy did it. McCarthy ended up getting the backing of what was known as the stalwart Republicans of Wisconsin, the most conservative Republicans, who hated La Follette, didn't especially like Joe McCarthy, but realized that this was the young guy who was ambitious and entrepreneurial enough that he was the guy that they were going to throw their cards in with, and it turned out to be a brilliant move. He beat La Follette in the primary. He went on to win easily against the Democrat in the fall, and he showed up in Washington as arguably one of the least unprepared people in that year of the Senate to take office, and yet the brashest and most successful politician. And Washington found out pretty quickly that Joe McCarthy was more than a force to be reckoned with.
You know, I read in your book that he at first, you know, they thought of McCarthy as, quote, you know, a gas bag and a pretender. But once he sort of got the bit in his mouth about communists in this country, that, you know, he realized that this was something really important, right?
So absolutely right. But it took, so he showed up in February of 1950 in an out-of-the-way place in Wheeling, West Virginia, with two speeches in his briefcase. The occasion was a Lincoln Day dinner, the ultimate Republican annual celebration of Abe Lincoln's birthday. One speech that McCarthy has in his briefcase is a snoozer of a speech on national housing policy. And had he picked that speech out that night to deliver, you and I wouldn't be talking about him half a century later. Instead, he delivered a barn burner of a speech where he said, "I have in my hand a list of 205 communists at the State Department and riddled throughout our government." And while he couldn't produce the names, and while the list wasn't real or wasn't meaningful, it was perfect for the moment. It was a moment when we were in the middle of a Cold War. It was a moment when Americans wanted a simple answer to what the problem was. And McCarthy said the answer was, behind every pillar at the State Department, there was a red. And he was going to name them, and he was going to expose them, and he was going to root them out. And who cared whether he did it? That night, every reporter in America decided that he was worthy of their front page.
How long from the inception of this was it until we get to the hearings?
So till we get to the most famous Army-McCarthy hearing,
right.
It was from February of 1950, a full 4 years later. And during those 4 years, Joe McCarthy had become the poster child for anti-communism in America. He had become the second most popular politician in America, with a full 50% of Americans endorsing his program, and the only person in the country that outweighed McCarthy when it came to public opinion was the president, Dwight Eisenhower.
It, obviously, though, in a lot of people in the country were very afraid, if not anti-communist, afraid of communists, right?
They were, and I think legitimately so. This isn't a book that's attacking... While I think we went overboard with our anti-communism, this isn't a book that's attacking the premise that the Soviet Union posed a threat to America in that era. The premise that I think we ought to be questioning is whether or not there were communists infiltrating our government, not the Soviet government, and whether or not Joe McCarthy had any clue who those anti-communists were. And most serious anti-communists that I interviewed for this book said the single worst person during that era for their movement was this false prophet, Joseph McCarthy.
I feel like he really tapped into a deeply ingrained fear with people. And I think if you can do that, obviously, you can make a lot of headway.
You can. We see today, we've seen with all the demagogues who came before Joe McCarthy and the ones who came afterwards, that if you've got a fear that you're building on and that you're tapping into in the American psyche, and if you've got a compelling and simple answer to that fear, people buy it. The fear was legitimate that communists were going to take over the world, and the simple answer was, I'm going to point out the traitors to you, and we're going to solve the problem. And people, for a long time, for those 4 years that we were talking about it, they bought it. But the day they stopped buying it, almost overnight, his popularity plummeted. He went from the beginning of 1954 at 50% to, at the end of the Army-McCarthy hearings, to 34%. Overnight, the bottom fell out. Overnight, people said, not him, he's not our prophet.
Those hearings where he was accusing people connected with the Army of being involved in this communist plot, and that was where the famous quote was, right?
So the quote was from Fred Fisher's senior associate. Fred Fisher was a young lawyer
who
McCarthy was accusing of having communist ties. Joe Welch, Fred Fisher's senior associate in Fred Fisher's firm, had a line that he was aching to deliver, and he was waiting for just the right moment. When McCarthy took off against his young associate, Fisher said to him, "Senator, have you no shame?" And that is a question that much of America had wanted to answer, and that the other half of America, the half that supported McCarthy, really started looking at him in a new way. And the guy that they saw coming into their living rooms on these television sets that they were addicted to night after night looked not like a hero, he looked like a town bully. And that's what they saw him as by the end of the hearings.
But what about all the folks that went to jail, lost their jobs? Were they rehabilitated fairly quickly? I heard a lot of them, it took a long time for them to sort of get their lives back.
Yes. So I have a whole chapter in the book that looks at exactly that question. It revisits the lives of McCarthy's targets, and it finds a couple things. It finds that some of them never could rehabilitate their career and their reputation. They had been smeared, and a smear sticks, and the jobs that they lost, they never got back. It found that others had suffered for the rest of their lives, that they had had this sense that they were somehow not in the mainstream, that they were not to be trusted. And it found that a small percentage of them actually committed suicide, that they took their own lives. They were so devastated by what happened to McCarthy. And McCarthy used to say all the time, point to one person who's really been hurt by what I've done. And I wish he could read that chapter, because there were thousands of people who were hurt, and there were dozens of people who lost their lives.
Yeah, and I think that sometimes it's easy to forget about what happened to them because you get so involved with the story of this man.
So So it's really disturbing, and what it raises is a question, and a question that lots of historians would disagree with me on. I think it raises the question of why the one person in America who could have taken down Joe McCarthy earlier and who knew how dangerous he was, and that is President Dwight Eisenhower, waited almost 2 years to do anything about him. And Dwight Eisenhower's brother, a very smart guy named Milton Eisenhower, was whispering in his brother the president's ear for a year and a half, saying, give up some of your popularity, take on that demagogue McCarthy. And Dwight Eisenhower didn't do anything until McCarthy overstepped his limits, until he took on the all-powerful U.S. Army. And then Commander-in-Chief Eisenhower, who loved the Army, stood up and said, you know, McCarthy's a bad guy. And I think that he could have done it earlier. He knew how bad McCarthy was, and he wanted to wait for McCarthy to do himself in, and lots of people suffered in the meantime.
It's that old saying about, you know, for evil to triumph, just good people doing nothing. Isn't that the saying?
Exactly. So that's exactly true, and the good people were partly senators and the president. The other good people were the half of the American public who supported McCarthy. And in the end, his number one enabler was the American public.
He did not live much longer. He died in 1957. He'd always been a big drinker, smoke. He wasn't exactly an ad for a healthy lifestyle. And so people maybe weren't too surprised when he died. But I remember reading in that book you wrote about Bobby Kennedy, and, you know, he and the Kennedys have been, from what you say, you know, good friends, and they did things together as families. They knew each other very well. And after he died, that Bobby Kennedy, and I don't know exactly if I'm saying this right, didn't he show up and kind of come in the back door at his wake?
He did. So he showed up at the funeral. His brother Jack, who wanted to run for president and wanted to win the Democratic Party's nomination, didn't want little brother Bobby showing up at the funeral of the arch-villain Republican. And so Jack Kennedy said, don't go. And Bobby said, thanks for that advice, and he went. But he stayed on the plane until all the other dignitaries had gotten off. When he got to the funeral, he went up into the loft, up into the balcony, so that nobody would see him. At the graveside service, he stood off to the side so nobody would see him. And he went up to all the reporters he knew there and said, I beg you, you'll get me in trouble with my brother Jack if you print my name among all the dignitaries who were there. And I heard this story from one of the reporters who 50 years later was trying to look for absolution for having left Bobby Kennedy's name out of a story that he knew that name should have been in there. And Bobby Kennedy, if you like Bobby Kennedy, you say he showed his loyalty to Joe McCarthy, who gave him his first meaningful job, by showing up at his funeral. If you don't like Bobby Kennedy, you say Bobby Kennedy was not this great iconic liberal figure. He was, in fact, a coal warrior, started out as a coal warrior of the same stripe as Joe McCarthy. But one of the other interesting things is all the coroner's records and all the newspapers said that Joe McCarthy died of acute hepatitis. For some reason, somebody in the military decided that they were going to turn over to me a box of 1,000 pages of McCarthy's medical records when he was treated at Bethesda Naval Hospital. And what he died of is what you said, not what the public knew at that time. He died of acute alcohol poisoning. He died of being a drunk. And it was very sad. From the day that the Senate censured him at the end of 1954 to his death nearly 3 years later, McCarthy was a destroyed guy. He had always been a heavy drinker, but he became an alcoholic. And in the end, that killed him.
You know, you were talking about Bobby Kennedy, and I remember when I was a kid, Bobby Kennedy, you know, going to, see the poor in Appalachia, visiting poor neighborhoods in the Bronx in New York. And he was sort of known as, a liberal for the people. But the thing was, he was someone who had a laser sort of focus on someone if he went after that person. I mean, he was dogged, and he did not let go, right?
He did. He didn't. And some people said that he showed a kind of ruthlessness in the way he went after people, and that was very reminiscent of Joe McCarthy. But it was interesting. The two of them were on exactly the opposite political trajectories. Bobby Kennedy started out as a Cold Warrior and ended up as a liberal icon. Joe McCarthy started out as an FDR New Deal liberal and ended up as a Cold War icon. And they were sort of passing in the night. Their intersection, thanks to Papa Joe Kennedy, to Jack and Bobby's father, who had always loved Joe McCarthy. Joe McCarthy was connected to Bobby by Papa Joe, and they had enough in common that Ethel Kennedy is the one who got me Bobby's widow, who got me intrigued by Joe McCarthy. Ethel Kennedy said, "Joe McCarthy might have been a monster to much of America, but to us, he was a joy. He was fun. He was the guy who played with our toddler daughter." And she got me thinking about Joe McCarthy in an entirely different way, thinking there must be something to this guy that was charismatic and charming for more than half of Wisconsin and for half of the country to buy into him. There must be something. And there was. He was every bit as vile a public figure as our image of him. But he's the guy that you and I would probably have loved to have gone out and had a beer with, because he was a great storyteller and a great charmer.
That was Larry Tye. He's the author of a new biography called Demagogue, The Life and Long Shadow of Senator Joe McCarthy.